On the 20th of September 2011, just a mere 9 days after the infamous terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center towers in New York City, as well as the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., the president at the time, George W. Bush, did a speech before a joint session of Congress. And I guess what he was trying to do was explain not only to Americans, but also to the world as to why these attacks had happened. And as well as doing that, what Bush was also doing was basically declaring what he called a war on terror, which of course shortly led to an invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. Bush was addressing a traumatized nation and a shocked world, really. And what he was trying to do, as I say, was trying to provide some sense of understanding and interpretation of the events, justification for why these attacks had taken place for the first time really on American soil. And so in Bush's view, what was the motivation behind, yes, these Muslim terrorists who attacked America? This is what George W. Bush had to say.
Americans are asking, why do they hate us? They hate what they see right here in this chamber, a democratically elected government. Their leaders are self-appointed. They hate our freedoms, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other.
According to Bush, then, this is why these Muslims, these Islamic terrorists, these extremists hate Americans. They hate our freedoms. They hate the fact that we have democratically elected institutions and that we can talk and disagree. And that is why, according to Bush, they attacked us. And of course, that would lead to a convenient justification of a long-running war in not just one, but two Muslim countries. And we're living with the effects of that decision by people that were in political power back then after these 9/11 attacks. And I think what it's done is it's only served to widen the already existing divide between, as it were, the East and the West, the Western world and the Islamic world. And even though Bush may have been referring to Islamic extremists in his speech, the ones who attacked us on American soil, what it does, in effect, is it paints virtually all Muslims with a very broad brush, us versus them. And once you make that move in a black and white sort of understanding, then we see things like Islamophobia, the fear and the hatred. And how do you go forward from there if you want to try to build any sort of meaningful and respectful relationship? It is very, very difficult. And it's precisely this situation that becomes the focus as well as the title of the book by this week's guest on Mindshift Podcast, Steve Slocum. And I'll let Steve explain exactly why he chose that title, which again was taken from the line in that speech by George W. Bush on the 20th of September. And really what Steve's focus now is as the book subtitle says, it's about making peace with the Muslim world. It's about understanding, increasing dialogue, basically getting to know your Muslim neighbors, those who are in your community. This can only be a good thing, ultimately. And in fact, this is now the focus of his life's work. Steve runs an organization out of San Diego called Salaam USA. That's S-A-L-A-A-M, Salaam USA. And you can find the information in terms of his contact details in the show note. And I believe this is a very timely and relevant topic, especially right now in our divided world. And in fact, after talking to Steve, it's made me kind of want to do some more research into this whole issue of understanding the world of Islam and understanding how the whole thing works as far as building bridges across that divide in terms of political, religious, social divides. There's a lot of work that we have to do, but Steve is going to provide us with some helpful tips in this episode for how we can do that, how we can begin to bridge that divide. It was interesting when we met up. We met up in Seattle when I was there back in September. He drove all the way down from Vancouver, British Columbia, where he was doing a conference and talking about his upcoming book. And he drove, it was probably a 7-hour drive. It was horrific traffic. We met up in Seattle that night. We sat down. We did this recording. Steve was very tired, but we got through it. And then the next day, we did our live podcast on the 16th of September, me and Stacy Ray in Seattle. So it was a lot of stuff going on that weekend. Steve ended up coming back out to the live podcast, and we all went to lunch afterwards. It was really good to get to know Steve a little bit more other than just going through the few minutes of our podcast recording. So I hope you enjoy this chat with me and Steve Slocum coming up in just a minute about his book, Why Do They Hate Us? But before I get into the conversation with me and Steve, I wanted to give a shout out to Bethany Carter. She is the newest supporter of Mindshift Podcast on Patreon. So welcome, Bethany. We've just added her into our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. So I'm looking forward to getting to know Bethany a little bit more. If you want to become a supporter of the show, that would be hugely helpful for the work that I'm doing. The links to my Patreon page are in the show notes. What do you get for being a supporter of Mindshift Podcast? Well, you get early access to every episode round about Wednesday of the week instead of having to wait till Friday. You also get some good behind the scenes conversations that I had with some of the guests that are on the show that I don't air as part of the podcast. And also I'm working on adding a video every month to my online course, which is called Reconstruction After Deconstruction. I've just done the second video, which is all about deconstructing biblical inerrancy. So if you've ever wondered what that's all about, what's the historical background and what the implications of biblical inerrancy, this doctrine, what have they been on the church starting out of fundamentalism and now affecting so many evangelical churches? And I break all that down in the video and talk about how it maybe has affected you, especially if you've come out of that kind of an experience. I'm pretty sure that this video, as well as the other ones that I'm going to be adding every month to the series, are going to be helpful for you in the process, not only of deconstructing your former faith or your experiences within religion, but as important as deconstruction is, there's another element to the whole story too, and that involves embarking on this journey of reconstructing an entirely new identity, something I've been focusing on a lot more this last probably 5 or 6 months, especially coming back to when I did that live podcast with Stacy Ray. And if you haven't heard that, it's a really good one because we interacted with a live audience on this subject of reconstruction after deconstruction. And we had a really great conversation with a bunch of ex-evangelicals that came all the way out to the studio for our live podcast. All right, that's enough talking about deconstruction and reconstruction. Let's go on into the chat with myself and Steve Slocum, recorded live in Seattle back in September. Let's talk about his book, Why Do They Hate Us? Making Peace with the Muslim World. I am joined here in the studio, as it were. This is a makeshift studio that I put together in a bedroom in Seattle, Washington, with Steve Slocum. Thanks for coming down all the way from Vancouver, Canada. But you're originally from, well, you're living in San Diego.
Correct.
So this has been an interesting journey. You've been from San Diego to Vancouver. Now you're in Seattle. Where are you going after we finish this weekend?
Just back to San Diego.
All right. San Diego. Stay classy, San Diego. It's got to be done. I'm sure you've never heard that before.
Honestly, I haven't.
Ron Burgundy is spinning in his grave right now. Well, I'm glad that we finally got a chance to get together, and it's been very lucky in a sense that it worked out to actually sit down and have this discussion, primarily about your book that's coming out. Or is it out now, or no, it's just about to drop?
It's finished. It's at the publisher. It's going to be released in January.
So it's coming out first of the year next year.
Yeah.
What is the title of the book? Can you tell us what it is?
It's called Why Do They Hate Us? Making Peace with the Muslim World.
Ah, okay. Now there's a lot going on in that, isn't there? Because the title itself obviously reflects someone hate someone else. You're saying Muslims in general, or is it about Christians, or is it about the West?
Well, the title of the book actually comes from George W. Bush's speech 9 days after 9/11. In that speech to the Joint Session of Congress, he said, he asked everybody, why do they hate us? And then he said his answer was, they hate our freedoms. And my premise in the book is that he used the pronoun they instead of saying a group of extremists. And so in general, the American people made a substitution for they of Muslims. Now it was, why do Muslims hate us? Muslims hate our freedoms. And even Donald Trump reinforced that idea on a CNN interview when he just came right out and said, I think Muslims hate our freedoms.
Well, and obviously Trump, as you say, he said that thousands and thousands of Muslims were cheering in the streets of New Jersey on 9/11, which is completely untrue, but it appeals to his base and all right. those kind of things. So it's fuel the fire, as it were, of the otherness of something. You can right. scapegoat somebody and you can, I mean, we've seen that historically, obviously, right. haven't we? In the past, other people have come to power by scapegoating a certain religious class or well, like Hitler did to the Jews, obviously, is an extreme example. But when you're fear mongering, it works. We know it works. Politicians are very adept at doing that. So. Right. This is a good strategy if you want to get votes and get supporters. So what led you to write the book? Was it around that time of Bush's speech and 9/11 and the aftermath of all that?
No, it was more recent, but my real motivation goes back to my 5 years as a missionary in Kazakhstan back in the 90s. During that time, I lived closely, deeply embedded in the Kazakh culture. With my family, I had 3 children, my wife at the time, and they treated us with so much respect and dignity, hospitality. It was just iconic hospitality. They literally were giving us the last of the food in their house to make sure that they were providing for their guests. So we just fell in love with the people. They were kind to us, kind to my whole family, and I felt that I owe them a debt. And so after 9/11, when all of this kind of anti-Muslim sentiment started to grow. I was feeling it. I didn't agree with either the invasion of Afghanistan and especially not the one of Iraq. And now in the days of Trump, I couldn't hold my silence any longer. I feel like I owe a debt to this hospitable, beautiful people, the Muslim people that are so diverse all over the world, and it's time to speak out. So that's why I wrote my book.
So you're speaking out. What do you hope to achieve with the book? What's the aim of this piece of, like you say, respectful dialogue? Is that part of the message behind it, the theme?
It is, but it kind of, the root of it is, I approach it from the point that 9/11 is a valid traumatic experience for Americans. Those of us who witnessed, you know, by watching video clips of, you know, airliners full of people smashing the side of buildings in a burst of flame.
Oh, absolutely.
And then watching the pancake collapse of the buildings. It's a bona fide trauma. So I approach it from that point that we need to acknowledge that trauma and then start to work at it, at healing that trauma through awareness. Who was this really? Why did they do that to us? And then who is Islam as a mainstream, who are the mainstream Muslims, and to sort of chip away at that fear when we understand what they're like.
Who would be the audience of the book? Who would you say needs to read this book?
So the audience to me is really all of America. It's kind of it was a collective kind of trauma. Bush in his speech kind of coalesced us in that. And we as a nation are invading other countries. We've killed millions of Muslims. And really most of us aren't really aware and we don't really skip a beat while our nation that represents us is, you know, invading Muslim countries and conducting a war on terror, kind of indiscriminately going about the killing. So that's kind of what I hope to accomplish, to help people be more aware of that.
I'm a big fan of history. Mm-hmm. So I've studied the Crusades and that might be the first example historically of the divisions between Christianity and Islam. Probably the first time when those two cultures collided around the Crusades. And there's been a lot of fallout from those times, even till today. I think George Bush even used the word crusade.
Yeah, he did.
At one point. And obviously he's hearkening back to, we're on a righteous crusade
right.
to, you know, get back at whoever did this, and we're right. going to find them. We're going to make them right. pay. Right. And there was the anger, the hatred. Yeah. And that's, he used that word very, you know, knowledgeably. Yeah. He knew exactly what he was saying there, I think.
Yeah, and I think he tried to take that back and say that, you know, this is not a war against Islam. He tried to clarify that, but I do remember him using the word crusade.
He used that word.
Yeah, and yeah, like you said, the actual original crusades did mark a big change in Christian-Muslim relations. Up until that point, they had gotten along famously, and Jews as well. They were considered favored people in the empire for centuries after Islam began. So yeah, it was the European invasion of the Islamic Empire.
They called it the Holy Land.
Yeah.
That was just their land.
And ironically, very ironic, it was called a holy war. It was the first, the original jihad.
It wasn't a Muslim thing, as it were, like we think today.
Yeah, there was.
They're on a holy war.
Yeah, to Muslims, jihad just means struggle. It doesn't even have a connotation of either holiness or war. It just means struggle. After the Crusades, the Islamic leaders came up with their own version of holy war in response to the Christian holy war against the Islamic Empire.
I think a lot of people think that the Crusades ended when they got booted out of the Holy Land, as it were, but it went on for at least a few hundred years more, the clashes between the Muslims and the Christians, as it were. I went to Rhodes in Greece a few years ago. There was a big battle there in 1522, so this stuff was still going on into the 16th century. They're still fighting the Knights Hospitallers and the Turks and all this, and the fall of Constantinople, all these things that happen. But you can see, to me, the repercussions have come right down to today. I mean, look at what's going on in Israel, the divisions between the Palestinians and the Arabs and the Jews, and, you know, all these people are jockeying for this little space. So yeah, we're seeing the repercussions of all those kinds of things historically, aren't we? So how are you going to fix all that this book?
Right. No, I mean, I cover the history really from just the mainstream. I don't get into a lot of the details of things that are going on.
You can go down a lot of rabbit holes.
Yeah. I cover a lot of material in 5 chapters. The first chapter is basically just the biography of Muhammad. A lot of really interesting details that most people don't know about. For instance, that he was an orphan and was cast out of the system. His wife was 15 years older, and she was twice widowed. They were both social outcasts. And so when he started getting his revelations, his heartbeat was social justice, and including the rights of women and the rights of those who are marginalized economically. Islam has a strong backbone in giving to the poor strictly. Their giving is strictly for the poor. It's not for private jets or anything like that.
Like our famous televangelist.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I can think of a few. One guy in particular, he's got not only a private jet, but a runway in his backyard.
There you go.
That somehow the church paid for. It's crazy. So yeah, you don't see that ostentatious amount of wealth and privilege. We probably should get into this at some point. I mean, obviously, Islam is not a monolith, is it, by any stretch?
No,
just like Christianity in that sense, then Judaism too. There are many, many sects and divisions, and some are more liberal, some are more fundamentalist. So you can't just say Islam and paint it with one broad brush and say it's all the same. It's not a monolith by any stretch. And there are some who are far more extreme, just like you have with, say, Christianity and Judaism.
Sure.
So how is that gonna work into all the stuff that you're covering in your book? Because obviously that, again, we can go down tons of rabbit trails.
Yeah.
Get lost.
I briefly summarize the major sects of Islam just for the sake of awareness, but I don't go into the details. I mainly track the details of the Sunnis, which form 90% of the Muslim world.
Right, that's the majority.
Yeah.
You have the Shia and the Sunni are kind of the two main branches, right?
Yeah, and then I cover one more, the Ahmadiyya, which is a growing sect. They actually believe in a successor to Muhammad that they call Messiah. I think they're on their fourth generation of that Messiah.
So they have a Mahdi kind of figure in there.
Exactly.
So you've got these different branches of Islam. I'm curious, what's it gonna do in terms of respectful dialogue? Is that what the aim of the book is? How is that gonna happen?
Okay.
Because we obviously here in the West, we're trying to proselytize
the evangelical culture is trying to proselytize everybody. So they're going to look at Islam as from a Christian point of view and say, well, they're incorrect. They're going to hell. We have to save these Muslims. But they're looking at Christians and saying, we got to convert them.
Yeah, I don't try to change, say, evangelical Christians' mind that Muslims, you know, need saving. I don't necessarily buy into that myself. I don't approach it. I look at it more from a secular standpoint and just educate people about how Islam began. The second chapter is about the empire and how that's actually dissociated from the religion. Yeah, most people don't realize that before the Quran even existed in written form and was distributed, the entire Islamic empire was already in existence.
It was already a thing.
Yeah. So anyway, I go into the history of the empire. Then I go into present-day practice of Islam. And I tell a lot of stories of my own experiences. I'm just trying to help people understand what Muslims are like so that the fear factor is not there. I tell my stories of going into the mosque, a lot of different Muslims that I've met over the years. Then I answer the question, why do they hate us? First, I define who they is. Okay, it's not the mainstream Muslims. It's a group of extremists. So then in the fourth chapter, I talk about why do those extremists hate us? And then I cover three important political events, which, you know, basically are the cause for modern Islamic terrorism. That is the overthrow of the democratic government of Iran by the CIA in 1953. Iran had a budding democracy and Britain wanted their oil and convinced the United States to actually overthrow this democratic prime minister. And so that's the source of the fundamentalist outbreak in Iran. It was strictly political. It was United States meddling in a democratic government, and they replaced him with the Shah, who was part of their dynasty.
A puppet of the CIA and the American government trying to achieve their aims, the Western ideology. Then you plug the oil factor into it.
Yeah.
That's obviously, you know, a huge thing, isn't it? I mean, I'm a huge fan of history. My period is World War I. So I've studied this back. Lawrence of Arabia, he's another figure where he worked with the Arabs to fight against the Turks, who were allied with the Germans. Right. And then he was telling them, look, if you fight with us against the Turks, we'll give you your country back. You'll have this as a free land. Well, they also told the French, well, you're going to have it. Mm. So of course, Syria after World War I became a French colony. And so all this stuff that's going on today, even in Syria, I think is still as a result of that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So you've got
sure.
colonialism, you've got meddling, as you say, by Western powers in all that region, and it's destabilized it so much.
Sure.
Is that part of why they hate us, to use George Bush's statement or infamous question?
Yeah, I mean, I cover the event after the issue in Iran is what happened in Afghanistan. And after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, well, so the CIA's strategy to keep Afghanistan from falling to the Soviets was to arm jihadists and teach them how to commit acts of terror against Soviet Union. And the CIA specifically trained the same body of people who turned into Al-Qaeda. So it was the CIA that created Al-Qaeda. They poured millions of dollars into weapons, into training, and literally trained these guys how to use these weapons. And some of these were Stinger missiles, you know, with capability up to 35,000 feet. They could take down a commercial airliner.
Yeah, that's pretty serious hardware there.
Yes. Yeah.
We're not giving them BB guns here. We're giving them, like, you can bring down a jet airliner 35,000 feet in the sky. So we created this Taliban, Al-Qaeda.
Well, not Taliban.
Oh, not Taliban.
A different story. It was just Al-Qaeda. Taliban emerged in the Civil War. Once the Mujahideen, the jihadists, were successful in driving out the Soviets, then the U.S. had zero strategy after that. No strategy.
No end game.
Yeah. So then it was just open civil war. And the Taliban actually emerged. They were a very austere, religious group, and they became a factor. They somehow coalesced and became the strongest faction in the Civil War. No one cared at the time that they also had this extremist version of Islam and Sharia law that is pretty scary. But no, the Afghans didn't care because they were stabilizing their country. And meanwhile, bin Laden had been driven out of Sudan by the United States. So he started holding up in Afghanistan. And since the CIA, since the U.S. didn't have any reach any longer in Afghanistan once the Soviets were gone and the Mujahideen weren't really working for the United States anymore, bin Laden was able to completely hole up and hide out with zero reach. The United States completely lost touch of where he was.
Yeah, so they couldn't get a hold of him. And meanwhile, he's building his network and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that at every twist and turn, you come back to some Western power meddling somewhere in the world. And what strikes me about all the rhetoric, though, that you hear from Western politicians like George W. Bush and others, every time there's a quote-unquote outrage that's committed somewhere, they take this high road sort of line. Why do they hate us? We've done nothing. Yeah. We're just a free society. That's why they hate us. No. You guys have had your fingers in so many pies all over the world. You've destabilized. You've caused havoc everywhere. You don't take any responsibility for any of it or very little of it. Yeah. Like Reagan down in South America, smuggling drugs into America to give weapons to the Contra. I mean, it's just in creating a huge drug problem here in America. Mm-hmm. The government did that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
And they've done so many things. And yet the average American might just go with the line of a George W. Bush. But yeah, they hate our freedoms. Yeah. That's what it is. Those Muslims, that's what their problem is.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I considered myself pretty well informed about, you know, that region. But after I started digging into what was really going on, I didn't think that about myself anymore. And I feel like if I, you know, I lived in Kazakhstan for 5 years, if I was completely clueless, I just wonder what the average, you know, American, where we tend to be kind of not that well informed about what our government is doing. And since we have a representative government, you know, they're doing it in our name. So we need to know. We need to be aware. And that's an important point that I'm making.
It would be nice to know if we could somehow figure out what it is they're doing around the world. They're not exactly forthcoming on a lot of this stuff. You find out through little leaks and dribs and drabs here and there.
Yeah.
But I would say, too, it's certainly not just an American issue, because in Great Britain, where I live, you hear the same types of rhetoric.
Sure.
The inflammatory speech around immigration, that was one of the things that fueled the Brexit vote, leaving the EU, because there was this big scare about, well, if Turkey is allowed to enter the EU, we're going to be flooded with hundreds of thousands of Turkish immigrants, and they're Muslims, and on and on and on. We can't have that. We've got to get out before that happens.
Right.
So this is, and you know, I've heard people say there's Sharia law in places like Birmingham and Leeds where there's huge Muslim population. So it's certainly not confined to America on any sort of level, is it? It's becoming a Western issue. And we're seeing immigrants coming from Syria and other places. They're trying to cross over into Europe. When we went to France, we saw in Calais, as we came across from Dover, the huge immigrant camps, and that's as far as they could come. To the French coast, and they were trying to get to Great Britain, but they couldn't get across.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a huge problem, isn't it? Immigration certain countries are taking them in. Some of them aren't. We're in a war torn world here, and we've created a lot of it though.
Right. Exactly.
Unfortunately in the West, but don't want to seem to take any responsibility for it.
Right.
So where are you going with the end game of your book? You said the Americans didn't have an end game in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Right.
If someone reads your book, what do you hope to have the outcome? What do you want that person to think, behave, believe differently as a result of your information? Yeah.
So the final chapter of the book kind of puts it all together. I've covered the history of Islam, what mainstream Islam is all about. Then I've covered history of terrorism and why Islamic extremism exists. It's not because of the teaching of Islam. It's because of politics. So then in the final chapter, so bring it to a close by offering up different options for getting to know Muslims, encouraging people to meet their Muslim neighbors, just talk to them and get the story straight from them, and stop reading the stuff on the clickbait and from what the evangelical teachers are saying, like Franklin Graham and others who are just promoting a bunch of lies. So it's all about getting to know your Muslim neighbor. Then once you know your Muslim neighbors and you start to realize that they're on our side, and you start to do more citizen advocacy for them and get involved. And then it leads into my nonprofit organization, which is called Salam, which I started basically to kind of promote the outcome of the book, which is peace and mutual understanding between Muslims and non-Muslims. So my organization, we do awareness events. We go to churches, we go to civic groups, any kind of organization that wants to hear about, you know, just what Islam is about. And I have a bunch of Muslim speakers that I bring, and they talk about the different elements of their faith, including answering the tough questions about jihad and Sharia law. What are those really, from the mouth of a Muslim? So, we do those events, and then we do friendship dinners. We get large groups together, and we cater a big Middle Eastern meal or something, and just mix the tables up 50-50, and everyone just has a great time, fantastic time. And yeah, so far, I've had several events, and all of them have been packed. All of them been maxed out. So that's been really encouraging.
So there's a good response
on
both sides of the table, as it were.
Yeah.
Do you find that there's more commonality when let's say, the average Muslim and average, whatever, even if it's a Christian person who's a little bit open-minded, do you find they find there's more commonalities between their religions than differences? Obviously, we know that Christianity, Judaism, and Islam all claim Abraham sort of as their spiritual father, and in some cases, they're physical descendants of Abraham in some cases. How does that work out when they actually do sit and have a discussion, an open, respectful discussion anyway?
Yeah, no, it goes great. I mean, really, everything, all of the issues that we have with Islam are based on misperceptions of everything, how it began. So many things are misperceptions. So once those misperceptions are cleared up and you get to know who these people are who are going to the mosque every Friday and just start hanging out with them, even visit the mosque. First time I ever went to a mosque, the sermon they gave was about Abraham, Aaron, and Moses. It was from the Bible.
Yeah, and the lessons, as far as you know, you could have been in a church.
Oh, totally.
Hearing the same basic sermon.
And we got up and we left and we went outside and there were kids running around coming out of their classes and there was a bake sale going on. And then, you know, so there was a table promoting some certain nonprofit, you know, charity stuff. I mean, I literally just felt like I was in church.
Could have been. Yeah. You really literally.
Yeah.
If you were a blind person, let's say, and you didn't know that you were surrounded by Muslims, you could have been in a church as far as you knew. You just sat through a regular sermon and, you know, heard everything a typical church preacher is going to say about the Bible and everything else.
Yeah. Once you get over the external differences, the fact they're sitting on the floor, the fact they take their shoes off and leave them cubbies on the outside, the fact that
there's obvious
the women
differences.
Are in the back and the men are in the front. But you go, I'd say 3, 4, or 5 times and you just stop noticing that, and then you start listening to what they're saying, and then you start realizing, you know, these people just want to do good. They really do. Every week they talk about how to do good, how not to respond in anger to these hateful attacks, you know, how to make a difference for good in the world. I mean, that's what you hear every week.
Yeah, so core values are very, very similar,
exactly.
If not the same.
Yeah.
You'd expect to hear those kind of things, again, exactly. In your typical church on a Sunday. But of course, there's too profound of differences, isn't there, between Christianity and Islam for too many people to get together. I mean, they're not going to. I had on this podcast Steve Stone Sr., who they call him the Starbucks pastor. He's out of Memphis, Tennessee, and he was pastoring a church there. And then there was a Muslim group that bought the lot next door.
Uh-huh.
And then they proposed to build a mosque there.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up befriending the leaders of this community, and they're two groups formed an amazing relationship.
Oh, nice.
And Starbucks did a video about this, about the community awareness and things like that, the very things you're talking about.
Yeah.
And yet he got obviously a lot of pushback from Christians and just regular everyday Joe Americans who were outraged at not only was this mosque being put down next to a church, you know, but that he was befriending these people. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to be their enemy. Or at least proselytize them, try to get them into your church and convert them, you know. So there's been a lot of interesting developments that came out of Steve's relationship, and he still does. They formed a foundation kind of similar to what you're doing, where they get together once a month, I think, the two groups, and they eat a meal together talk and just get to know each other on just a human level, kind of leaving the proselytizing aside. So it's amazing what can happen if people can just get over themselves, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you found that to be the case anyway, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm finding among the mainstream Christian groups like Protestant denominations, Methodists, Episcopals, they're just wide open. Evangelicals have the sticking points of, you know, the deity of Christ, the Holy Trinity that the Muslims kind of have trouble with.
And they have a strict monotheistic God, yeah, really, Muslims.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are sticking points. And also, you know, I mean, it's a sticking point when your orthodoxy says that, you know, if you believe in a certain way, you're going to go to heaven and everybody else is going to go to hell. I mean, that makes it difficult to, you know, have a mutual conversation about anything. That's a tough crowd. I do have a good friend. I do have a good friend who, I served with. He was the director of the mission that I was with when I was in Kazakhstan, and he's since graduated to peacemaking in the evangelical church with Muslims. He's doing a great work. He has a really tough crowd. He takes a lot of heat for what he's doing. He takes a lot of heat for saying things like Muslims worship the same God and things like that. And he would, I don't want to speak for him. I don't want to get him in trouble either.
Yeah,
so I won't say any more about him, but he's doing great work. And he's also in the San Diego area. So I just visited him last week. He's actually recovering from surgery for liver cancer. So he's had a really close call.
Very close shave.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
It's any kind of cancer or whatever is tough, isn't it? But yeah. Well, no, I was thinking here, we never actually answered the question, why do they hate us? And I don't want to give too much away for the book itself, but you said you answer that question. I just had this thought occur to me. We didn't hear the answer to the question, why do they hate us? And now we know you've explained the context around why George W. Bush used that phrase and the otherness of Muslims and all that. But what do you think is the answer? Because clearly there's a conflict. There's no doubt about it.
Right. Well, all you have to do is read Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's letter to Obama. It's published in the Miami Herald. And he goes into great detail as to why the 9/11 attacks occurred. And all the people who say that, you know, Islam just wants to establish Sharia law around the world and take over the world, well, you won't find anything about that in there. You'll find a long list of political grievances. And there are a couple of interviews of actual Osama bin Laden taken in a cave in Afghanistan. A couple of journalists were able to get interviews with him, and it's the same thing. He says nothing about, you know,
the religious ideology.
Yeah, just
spreading nothing. Islam at the edge of the sword and all that kind of stuff.
Nothing.
It's you hear all, that, though. Yeah.
And, you know, if you study the history, I encourage people to study the history from academics. There's a lot of good academic work out there, historical. There's a ton of information in academics, and it all tells the same story about Islam, and it has nothing to do. We have so many misconceptions about it.
That they hate our freedoms.
And it never started with the edge of the sword. It was a social justice movement that grew the same way that Christianity grew, because people liked it, because the poor were being taken care of, and they flocked to it because here was a leader who was promoting their rights.
Yeah, it was compelling. So
yes,
gained momentum.
Yes.
But what you're hearing now, as you say, so there's more of a list of grievances, legitimate grievances, mm-hmm. of things that the West has done to them on Correct. So many levels, so many injustices. Yeah, they're pissed off. They're angry, yeah. rightly so. Right. But of course, the fact that there is an extreme end to Islam, that's another sticking point. As you say, you've got Christianity who has these certain theological sticking points. But for a lot of people, they're saying, well, they're committing acts of terror. They're running people down in buses in mm-hmm. France and in London and doing things in America. It's hard to get over those things, isn't it? Because there's a lot of built up resentment on both sides now. It's sort of like Northern Ireland in a way, isn't it? The fact that you've got all these murders and bombings and killings that have went on for years and years and years. Now they want to have peace. Right. It's not so easy to shake hands with the guy who murdered your friend.
Of course. But does anyone say that those bombings took place because Catholics, you know, want to take over the world? No one says that. They happen to be Catholics.
Yeah.
And these terrorists happen to be Muslims. But their grievances are 100% political.
That's the question, too. So how are we going to solve that problem? Are you looking to, if you said, look, let's just do a grassroots movement among the average person, American, Brit, whoever they are, who's read your book, is that going to help? That's got to help, obviously, just on a neighborhood, neighbor-to-neighbor, person-to-person level. How is that going to impact the political world? Because they're making decisions. We have no say in any of it. Right. If they're going to push a button and launch 59 cruise missiles into Syria, you and I aren't going to stop it.
Right. I'm hoping that this awareness will at least start to open our eyes about what is going on in our foreign policy, and that on a grassroots level, little by little, as we get to know our Muslim neighbors, as we understand that they're really our friends and they're actually our allies in the struggle against terror, that people will become more aware of that, and that will reflect itself in how our elections turn out and in the inability of politicians to use fear to get themselves elected and then go off on their campaigns to bomb whoever they want to bomb.
Bomb whoever you want to bomb. Well, it sounds like a great thing to try and accomplish. It's certainly at a grassroots level. If you can change one person and their neighbor, get them to talk, then you've helped one or two or three people or two families or whoever. It might help overall, as you say, eventually impact the political world. But it's a long, you got a long way to go, man.
Sure. Well, I'm not the only one doing this. There's a lot of other people doing it, and we're finding each other. And I find that's, you know, one reason why I ended up in Vancouver, and here in Seattle, there's more and more people who are becoming aware of it. And, you know, we're starting to do something about it. And, you know, that's how movements grow. And I hope this one, you know, grows like
I hope it grows. So how can people get a hold of you if they said, Steve, what you're talking about is really fascinating, aside from reading your book? What's the best way to contact you social media-wise and all those other platforms?
So my website is www.salamusa.org. That's salam with two A's.
So S-A-L-A-A-M.
Correct.
Right.
Salamusa.org. And that's also my Facebook is salamusa. And then my Twitter is salam_USA.
Right. So you've got the whole branding thing going. See, that's very smart. Because all you got to remember really is that name, Salam, and you could probably find Steve somehow.
Yeah.
Is it possible if people wanted you to come to their community, you're saying you do these events.
Oh, yeah.
Is that something that you'd be into?
Absolutely.
Anywhere they'd have you, as you said.
Absolutely. That's what we do. And I can line up Muslim speakers. Any place where there's a group, we'll have an event.
So that sounds great. Well, thank you, Steve Slocum, for sitting down with me. This has been really interesting. I've learned a lot. I feel like I'm coming away a little bit more educated on the political side, too. I mean, that's an interesting piece, isn't it? The issue of the political grievances. But that's all been wound up in religious ideology and American political stuff. So we got to unpick this knot here, this Gordian knot, and kind of try to figure out what can we do going forward. So thank you so much. We're going to go have a pub dinner, I think, in a little bit.
Yeah.
And then you're going to a concert.
That's right.
So there's a lot to do tonight. And then we got a live podcast tomorrow. So we're looking forward to all these things kind of coming together. But thanks, Steve, so much for being on Mindshift Podcast. I really appreciate you coming all the way down from Vancouver. It's a long drive fighting the traffic.
Yeah.
And it's just been a nightmare, I guess, coming down here, hasn't it?
But it's okay. Thanks for having me.
You made it. All right. Thank you, Steve. Yeah. Once again, I would like to thank this week's guest, Steve Slocum, from San Diego by way of Vancouver, Seattle, and now United Kingdom, where I'm actually doing this recording and putting the podcast together. So it's a global effort to bring you this episode with Steve as we talked about his book, Why Do They Hate Us? Making Peace with the Muslim World. And I hope it's provided you with some insights, some historical background, some of the context between the Muslim world and the Western world. And what I really appreciate about Steve is that he's not just talking about it in a dry academic sense. He's actually offering up practical advice for how to connect, how to build relationships with your Muslim coworkers, neighbors, people in your community, even on a grassroots level. He's even willing to come to your town, your city, and put on a conference so that you can have a meaningful dialogue with people that you need to get to know, really. And this is where it can start.
as I say, on a grassroots level. So thank you, Steve, for being a great guest this week on Mindshift Podcast. If you want to connect with Steve and his organization, Salaam USA, take a look in the show notes and you'll find all of Steve's contact information as well as mine. You can send me your thoughts and questions and comments on Twitter. It's probably the best way to do it. You can follow me there at MindShift2018. Let me know your feedback on this or any other episode that I've done. Now, what's coming up next week? My last recording that I did when I was in the Seattle area, I actually went down to Portland in Oregon. I drove down there, spent the weekend, stayed with Andrew Gurevich, who was one of my guests on this show last year. We talked about him leaving religion, leaving evangelicalism, and getting into all kinds of interesting stuff, such as Paleolithic cave art. And so we had a great conversation. In fact, you can catch those episodes. They're always on Podbean or on my website, preachersforum.com. You can find those episodes that I did with Andrew Gurevich last year. So we're going to have another talk. We're going to come back and talk about this issue of reconstruction after deconstruction from his point of view. So that's coming up next week right here on Mindshift Podcast. Thanks for joining me and Steve Slocum as we talked about his book. I hope you learned something and I want to hear from you. Let me know what you think. I'll see you next Friday. Yeah.